America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends. We have a fascinating day today. In the second hour of our program, Michael Chapman is going to be here. When are the conservatives going to wake up to discrimination against gays the way America woke up, conservatives ultimately, to discrimination against interracial couples in the 1960s, at least legal discrimination? In our third hour, Edward Hartman, no relation, is going to be talking about the population problem and when growth isn't good. Let's defy conventional wisdom. Christy Harvey will be here with News Under the Radar. We're going to do our best of the rest of the news segment in the third hour, the last half of our third hour. Steve Rendell from FAIR and Nancy Scola from AirAmerica.com. A couple of bloggers, posters, the website, the tubes, not the trucks, will be with us. So that's what's coming up today. I want to start out with, he's the winner! He's the winner! It's incredible! Ron Paul won the Republican debate last night, according to Fox News. Here's the clip.
And here are the results as of now. In first place with 35%, Ron Paul. Rudy Giuliani came in second.
Oh, here we go again.
Driving Hannity crazy.
It's driving me crazy.
With 16% of your votes, 17% of your votes that just changed. In third place, Mike Huckabee. We'll talk to in just a moment. 15%.
So Ron Paul, just about 2-1 over Giuliani and Huckabee. It's incredible. And now, the question, I'm sure that the Republicans are sitting around scratching their heads, because Ron Paul, I watched the debate last night, and the Republican debate in New Hampshire, and the boo line when I forget which one it was, I think it was Brownback, went after gay marriage, and it was just amazing. And Ron Paul, he actually held his own. And so the Republicans have to be sitting around scratching their heads right now going, okay, is this that the Republican base really likes Ron Paul? Or is it that Fox News viewers really like Ron Paul? And they represent some sort of the fringe of the fringe. Or is it the Ron Paul's the guy that we should run as you know, the lead candidate for president? And why is it the national polls don't show Ron Paul? And I would say that actually in response to the latter, it's the same thing with the Democratic side. On the Democratic side, in those states where the candidates have been campaigning a lot and everybody actually knows the candidates, by and large, John Edwards is way out ahead. He's way out ahead in the Iowa polls. He's way out ahead in the New Hampshire polls, generally speaking. And whereas when you do the national polls, you find that Hillary Clinton is usually the lead. And the reason why is because national polls right now, nationally, people aren't paying attention. National polls are simply the however you phrase the question, the bottom line is what they're asking really is name recognition. And Rudy Giuliani has enormous name recognition. Chris Matthews has been working on this for a year and a half, pumping Rudy Giuliani as hard as he can, and much of the rest of the mainstream media along with him. And obviously, you know, 9/11, the mayor of New York, all that kind of stuff. Incredible name recognition. So the national polls are going to show name. And obviously Hillary Clinton has name recognition. It's probably 100% in the United States. You'd be very hard pressed to find anybody who doesn't know at least what, you know, who she is or what, you know, recognize her name. So the Republicans have got to be sitting around scratching their heads going, what's the deal here? Here's Ron Paul and Mike Huckabee mixing it up for the debate last night.
I'm saying we should take our marching orders from our Constitution.
Now, this was in response to Sean Hannity. It wasn't Sean Hannity. It was one of the Fox guys says, you know, after Ron Paul says we should pull out of Iraq, he says, oh, so we should take our marching orders from bin Laden? And this is Ron Paul's response.
I'm saying we should take our marching orders from our Constitution. We should not go to war. We should not go to war without a declaration. We should not go to war when it's an aggressive war. This is an aggressive invasion. We've committed the invasion of this war, and it's illegal under international law. That's where I take my marching orders, not from any enemy.
Over this way.
And it's amazing this is a Republican crowd. I mean, a well-vetted Republican crowd at the University of New Hampshire last night. And Ron Paul going over pretty well, actually.
The American people didn't go in.
This is Ron Paul still.
A few people advising this administration, a small number of people called the neoconservatives, hijacked our foreign policy. They're responsible, not the American people. They're not responsible. We shouldn't punish them.
Congressman, we are one nation. We can't be divided. We have to be one nation under God. That means if we make a mistake, we make it as a single country.
Now, this is Mike Huckabee trying to pull the patriotism card. Let's ignore the logic here. Let's just swell our chests out and pound on them.
The United States of America,
no.
Not the divided states of America.
When we make a mistake, it is the obligation of the people through their representatives to correct the mistake, not to continue the mistake.
Then Ron Paul going back to the Constitution.
And that's what we do on the floor of the Senate?
No, we've dug a hole for ourselves and we've dug a hole for our party.
Now, this is where Ron Paul, frankly, I think made a huge mistake because he just set himself up to be knocked over. You know, he's pointing out the reality that the Republican Party is being destroyed by this war or by this ongoing occupation. And even Ron Paul gets that right. But he also sets himself up for being called political.
Losing elections and we're going down next year if we don't change it. And it has all to do with foreign policy and we have to wake up to this fact.
Even if we lose elections, we should not lose our honor. And that is more important than the Republican Party.
We've lost over...
And see, that was the obvious, you know, rebuttal to that. You know, it's such an easy one. I mean, you know, Ron Paul just set himself up to get knocked over with that. But nonetheless, Ron Paul still comes back. I mean, he's still holding his own.
We have lost over 5,000 Americans killed in Afghanistan. We've lost over 5,000 Americans over there in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and plus the civilians killed. How many more do you want to lose? How long are you going to be there? How long? What do we have to pay to save face? That's all we're doing is saving face. It's time we came home.
Yeah. So, you know, Ron Paul speaking out. I mean, it's really, really quite extraordinary. But then you get the, you know, how radical this guy is. And this is why the Republicans are afraid of him, because he's a libertarian. And libertarians fundamentally don't believe in any role of in government having any role other than the punitive one. I mean, as I've said it, you know, 1,000 times in this program, libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. They don't think that there should be laws against prostitution. They don't think that there should be laws against illegal drugs. And they're hyper-conservatives. They're ultra-conservatives. And so the setup question here.
Congressman Paul, your answer is to cut both taxes and spending. You say that you would eliminate the IRS, the CIA, the Federal Reserve, the Department of Homeland Security, Medicare. I know that you used to want to...
I'm not sure who the laughing is. Whenever Ron Paul was asked a question, somebody with a mic on was laughing. And who was that, David?
That was Hannity laughing.
Oh, that was Hannity laughing. Oh, interesting. So Sean Hannity throughout this thing was the guy who was laughing every time Ron Paul said something. And
yeah, he was laughing every time.
Interesting. Because I didn't think that you know, it was so undignified. I didn't think it would have been any of the Republican presidential candidates. So anyway, that's story number one. Story number two, another interesting thing today. I think this is frankly even more interesting. That's sort of like, what's going on in the world of politics? But the story from the local paper: a B-52 bomber was mistakenly armed with 6 nuclear warheads and flown for more than 3 hours across several states last week, prompting an Air Force investigation and the firing of one commander, Pentagon officials said Wednesday. The actual story from the Army Times by Michael Hoffman, staff writer: B-52. Mistakenly loaded with 5 nuclear warheads, flew from Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana on August 30th, resulting in an Air Force-wide investigation. Now, Larry Johnson, who is often a guest on this program, in fact, we called him about this, and he's on a plane right now, so he couldn't come on the program, but he's blogged about this over at his website, and I think that this is a really important point he makes. He says, why the hubbub over a B-52 taking off from a B-52 base in Minot, North Dakota, and subsequently landing at a B-52 base in Barksdale, Louisiana? That's like getting excited if you see a postal worker in uniform walking out of a post office and into another post office. How does someone watching a B-52 land identify the cruise missiles as nukes? It just doesn't make sense. He says, so I called an old friend, a retired B-52 pilot, and asked him, and here's what his friend said. Barksdale Air Force Base is being used as the jumping-off point for Middle East operations. Gee, why would we want cruise missile nukes at Barksdale Air Force Base? Can't imagine we would need them to use in Iraq. Why would we pre-position nuclear weapons at a base conducting Middle East operations? His final point was to observe that somebody on the inside obviously leaked the information that the planes were carrying nukes. A B-52 landing at Barksdale is a non-event. With nukes, that's something else. So is this pre-positioning for a nuclear attack on Iran? 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Just in from the wire services, as they say in the news business, less than 1 week after announcing his intention to resign from office, embattled Senator Larry Craig, Republican from Idaho, changed course today, telling reporters in Washington, "I will not blow this job." Over the last few days, there have been whispers in Republican circles that Senator Craig had, in the words of one of the Idaho's senator's associates, pulled out too early. The associate said, "At the end of the day, Larry does not want to blow this job. He will do whatever it takes to win back the support of his constituents, even if it means getting down on his knees." Another associate of Senator Craig's agreed that the Idaho senator announced his intention to vacate his Senate seat too hastily. Said the associate, "I think Larry now feels that to leave office on September 30th would be a premature evacuation." Senator Craig got a key vote of support from Senator Arlen Specter, the Republican from Pennsylvania, who held a press conference at the Senate today to call the charges against the Idaho senator a bum rap. But even as Senator Craig picked up the support of Senator it's awful hard to read this story. But even as Senator Craig picked up the support of Senator Specter, a source close to the Republican caucus indicated that most Republicans are, quote, backing away, end quote, from Senator Craig. For his part, Senator Craig told reporters that he would take whatever steps are necessary to find favor with his Republican colleagues. Said Senator Craig, quote, "I will absolutely bend over backwards."
Naughty boy, bad boy, a naughty boy, a nasty, bad, naughty boy.
Yeah, and that from the wire service is also known as the BorowitzReport.com. Andy Borowitz, thank you very much for that, Andy. And a moment of light humor as we're considering the possibility that a U.S. bomber flying nukes to Barksdale Air Force Base may have simply been pre-positioning them. This from the Global Security Newswire, Greg Webb writing. He said a U.S. Air Force strategic bomber flew with at least five nuclear-armed cruise missiles last week, apparently violating nuclear weapons handling policies that stretch back nearly 40 years. There were five W-80 nuclear warheads, each with an adjustable yield between 5 and 150 kilotons. The risk of flying accidents led the United States to abandon all nuclear-armed bomber flights in 1968. Why 1968? Because on January 21st, 1968, a U.S. B-52 carrying a nuclear weapon crashed in Greenland. And while the nuclear weapon didn't explode, the radioactive material did get loose and contaminated the area. And so Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, that day, January 21st, 1968, ordered the grounding of all nuclear-armed aircraft, and that policy has continued right up until today. So what's going on? Jim in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, I just wanted to make a quick comment here. I flew on B-52s for about 1,000 hours, okay? I have many...
That's a lot of flying.
That's a lot of flying.
Speaking as a pilot, that's a lot of flying, 1,000 hours.
I was not a pilot. I was air crew. But in all that time, we never flew with any weapons on board.
Right.
Period.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only reason you would fly with weapons on board is if you were taking them to drop on somebody.
Right.
The public has a perception that, you know, the military goes out and drops practice bombs and things like that. They do not. You know, maybe the Navy does a few times, you know, fires a few missiles at some targets. But as far as strategic bombers go, you don't go out and drop practice bombs on things.
Right.
It just doesn't happen.
Now, so, in your mind, this was, it's not possible that this was an accident. So could it have been, as Larry Craig suggests, the former CIA officer and former State Department official, counterterrorism official, Larry Johnson, excuse me, I keep calling him Larry Craig. Could it have been that this was pre-positioning, getting them to Barksdale Air Force Base, which is the jumping off point for any operations against Iran?
I didn't find that difficult to believe because I think they would transport them some other way. I mean, the idea of transporting on a bomber from one base to another just seems extremely far-fetched to me, unless there was another specific purpose.
Do you think this was a screw-up par excellence, or do you think that there's something going on here we're not being told?
I'm tempted to believe that this is, like you say, a screw-up par excellence where some very bad mistakes were made along the way. I don't want to believe that our government is pre-positioning nukes that way or setting up an attack for Iran. I don't want to believe that. I'm not saying it couldn't happen.
I would prefer not to believe it either, but we've got, you know, Seymour Hersh, and you've got a bunch of good investigative reporters who have good connections mostly inside Cheney's office. And we know that Cheney has been pushing for 2 years now to attack Iran.
Well, the other thing I would ask ourselves is, they made a comment that these cruise missiles were being decommissioned in some fashion. Now, it should be real easy to find out if there is a program for decommissioning old cruise missiles.
Right, and if so, why would it be at Barksdale Air Force Base? Why wouldn't it be at a place where you do that kind of thing? Jim, we're out of time. I appreciate the call. Got to take the break here at the bottom of the hour. 27 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com for our blog, TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, our message board. And also, you can see our C-SPAN program. And drop in and say hi to the live chat room. I'll be there right now.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's not forget our, I'm lacking an adjective here, our president.
Iran has arrested visiting American scholars who have committed no crimes and pose no threat to their regime.
Recently released them.
Iran's active pursuit of technology that could lead to nuclear weapons threatens to put a region already known for instability and violence under the shadow of a nuclear holocaust.
Now, this was just, what, a week or so ago? Bush talking like this? And, well, I guess time will tell. We'll see if there's more leaks on this. But also, the whole point that this even leaked out in the first place, was this an attempt by a whistleblower to say, hey, there's something going on here that you all need to know about? Jack in San Diego, listening on KLSD. Hey, Jack.
Well, you know, you make a good point because this is definitely a story that probably should have never seen the light of day. But I'd like to make a suggestion. If there's any way you could get the Comptroller General David Walker on your show as a guest, I would like...
He's been on the show several times.
Has he?
Yeah.
I guess I
must have
missed those shows. But, you know, recently Congress gave him the authority to investigate and report on the benchmarks set for Iraq.
Right. A very interesting testimony. Was it yesterday, the day before, where the Republicans were saying to him, you know, you don't have the experience. And he's like, you know, we do have the experience. We have experienced people, military experience. And by the way, Robert Gates doesn't have any military experience. I mean, it was real. Keith Olbermann, I believe, played the clip last night on Countdown.
Well, I saw him the other day
one of the few real news shows out there.
I saw him the other day on C-SPAN, and he stressed the fact that the Government Accountability Office is totally independent. And
that's right. They're beholden to no one.
Well, they work for Congress. They investigate for Congress, and he stressed not the president. I would like to see Congress give the GAO the authority to do an audit of our nuclear inventory.
And it's a good idea.
I think we need to remember how many times that Bush and Cheney has tried to scare the hell out of us by telling us that there will be mushroom clouds over our cities.
Yeah. No, it's they're just constantly playing the fear card. You're absolutely right, Jack. And that's why I say, you know, we need to say we're not afraid anymore. Sorry, guys, we're not afraid. And there's a lot of things that can kill you, you know, from tobacco to a drunk driver. There's a lot of things that are going to kill many of us. You know, hundreds of thousands of us are going to die every year here in the United States from things that we probably could have avoided or not to mention, you know, one out of three Americans getting cancer because of all the weird stuff in our environment and our foods, pesticides, herbicides, plasticizers. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And yet we don't sit around in abject terror. We try to do something about it, obviously. But sorry, George, we're not going to be afraid anymore. Steve in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. I heard you refer this morning to Larry Johnson having posted on his website he's 80% sure that a plan's being drawn up to attack Iran. And I also want to say that
actually, that would have been Carl who said that. I didn't say that. But,
Clinton and Obama aren't helping us much with their continual demonizing of Iran. But I want to say, if such an outrageous thing does happen, does actually occur, can we finally quit saying we support the troops? If the troops willingly take part in such an action, I mean, right now they're taking part in the illegal occupation of Iraq. But if it continues on, at what
the
point
job, the job of a soldier is not, broadly speaking, is not to decide whether his orders are legal. There are obviously, you know, the Geneva Conventions, the rules of war, international treaties, and U.S. law. If you are given an order that you know is illegal, then you have an obligation not to fulfill that order. But by and large, I mean, you know, when we're talking about at the level of policy, these soldiers, by and large, it's not their job to decide whether or not Bush lied us into a war. I'm sorry. I'm just, you know, ain't going to go there. Ken in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Ken.
Hey, if you're suffering from a shortage of adjectives for the commander-in-chief, I got a few for you.
Well, I'm suffering from a shortage of adjectives that I can use on the radio.
Okay, well, I'm on Sirius, but I'll refrain. Anyway.
So, what's up?
You know, what if this the placement of the story of the placement of these warheads on the B-52s was nothing more than a Karl Rovian kind of last goodbye, that there was no such thing, but they just did the saber rattling and just planted the story?
Yeah, or that maybe this was designed to ratchet up tension in the region. We had a caller to the morning show here on AM 620 KPOJ who suggested that or who said that the reports are out. I have not found this news report yet, but that as a consequence of this, the military is going to ground all the B-52s for a day on the 14th or something like that. And, you know, sort of like, everything was grounded on 9/11. I don't know. I mean,
government engenders, you know, even if I'm dead wrong. This is the kind of thinking. This is the kind of backward thinking, so unproductive and so malevolent. Can I offer one other quick thought, though, regarding Larry Craig? Isn't it wonderful, as you've noted, that the Republican convention is going to be in Minneapolis and that all the attendees may just be going right past that particular men's room?
Yes, unless they decide to boycott it because they're
naughty
all...
Boy, oh, bad boy,
Larry,
naughty boy.
Larry, ouch!
Well, I'm just wondering.
Naughty boy.
Larry... Maybe the RNC.
He keeps popping up, you know. Go ahead.
So maybe the RNC could put together a little tourist guide of great men's rooms around the Minneapolis-St. Paul area.
There you go.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the call. And just the guy to do it is a certain reporter from the White House press pool who was spending hundreds and hundreds of hours in the White House, and we still don't know with whom or why, leaving at strange hours of the night. Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
You were talking about Ron Paul in last night's Republican Party debate.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told that he actually won the straw poll down in Alabama. The media is going completely out of their way to ignore Ron Paul, just like they ignored the death of Aaron Russo a couple of weeks ago. And Aaron Russo accomplished so much.
Wait a second. Aaron Russo died?
Yes, of bladder cancer.
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm sorry to hear that. He was a guest on this program. His program Freedom to Fascism is a reasonably good movie.
Yes, and the untold part of this campaign, of course, is that Ron Paul appears very extensively in that movie. I was wondering if I could give out a website for Aaron Russo's family, because the medical bills are just astronomical. www.russomedicalfund.com.
Okay, how's Russo spelled?
R-U-S-S-O.
Yeah, just like you would think, medicalfund.com. Joe, thanks a lot for the heads up on that, and I appreciate the call. Katrina in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hey, Katrina.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I was calling about Ron Paul and the reasons why I think that he won that debate.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons is because anytime you're using using text messaging, you're looking at a different demographic there, and it's usually young people. And people overwhelmingly are against the war, against what the abuse of government. So I think that's one of the reasons. They're the ones that are, text messaging their votes, and they're going to, account for him winning that debate.
I think you're right. And also, Katrina, the young people, by and large, don't realize exactly what libertarian is all about. They do realize that the libertarians say that gay marriage should be decriminalized, or should be legalized, however you want to say it, that prostitution should be decriminalized, that the use of drugs should be decriminalized. And they don't realize that libertarians also want to do away with, for example, any possibility of any kind of government involvement in health care, no national health care program, do away with Medicare, do away with Medicaid, do away with public support for education, privatize all our roads, turn them over to corporations, make toll roads out of them. Basically do away with sell off all of our national parks. I mean, they don't get how extreme libertarians are. And I find it really interesting. A lot of the guests that we have on this program who have been regulars over the 5 years that we've been on the air, from conservative think tanks, for example, the other day we had a guy on from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, one of the senior analysts there. And, I called him a conservative on the air. He's been on the program before. It's, a couple of times over the years, and he's always proudly called himself a conservative. He says, well, I'm not a conservative. I'm a libertarian. It's like they're rebranding themselves. The same way that they say, well, liberals don't want to call themselves liberals. They call themselves progressives. I like both words, frankly, liberal and progressive. But conservatives increasingly are afraid of that word. And so they're fleeing towards the libertarian word. And in part, it's because you've got, libertarian cheerleaders out there like John Stossel who are doing their very best to basically hide the dark side of libertarianism, which is that it is anti-small d democratic. Libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get high, bottom line. And libertarians will turn this country over to big corporations and the wealthy inherited wealth, period. John in Fallbrook, California. Got about a minute before we got to take a break. John, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to address the issue of soldiers taking individual responsibility for themselves. I was in the 82nd Airborne Division during the Vietnam War, and I came to a point where I just felt I could no longer in good conscience participate in that. And at my court-martial, I testified that the Nuremberg trials established a soldier's not only their right to object to specific wars, but had a duty to do so. And
that's right.
So I really think soldiers do have to take a look at what they're participating in.
Well, and there are a number of soldiers who are taking stands against the war in Iraq on those principles. But at the same time, the Vietnam War, by the time that was happening with you, I would say it was so obvious to everybody that that war was just a pure criminal action. And there's still an enormous...
Go ahead. Yeah, it was 1966. That wasn't so early.
Yeah, you're right. Okay. Well, I salute you, John, for your service to our country and for being prescient, for seeing the truth as it was. Thank you for the call. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Come on, show.
Yeah, see, it's the love and the hate. I mean, the contrast. Let me just share a story with you. This is actually, it happened back in May. In Asheville, North Carolina, one of our Asheville listeners, or is that South Carolina? I forget. I'm sorry. I'm Carolina challenged. I'm Dakota challenged as well. In any case, it happened back in the 26th, and there was a group of neo-Nazis, or not neo-Nazis, the actual Nazis, the VNN, Vanguard Nazi, and the KKK got together, and they came in, and they were doing this march. And so as they're marching through the streets, a group of clowns, the 100th ARA, Anti-Racist Action Clown Brigade, the clown block, came. And this is what happened. Just reading from the Asheville Indie Media news story here. White power, the Nazis shouted. White flower, the clowns yelled back, running in circles, throwing flour in the air and raising separate letters which spelled white flower. And there's actually a picture of this, you know, on the site. White power, the Nazis angrily shouted once more. White flowers, the clowns cheered and threw white flowers in the air and danced about merrily. White power, the Nazis once again tried in a doomed and somewhat funny attempt to clarify their message. Oh, the clowns yelled, tight shower, and held a solar shower in the air, and all tried to crowd under to get clean as per the Klan's directions. At this point, several of the Klan and Nazi and Klan members began clutching their heads as if they were about to have a heart attack. Their beady eyes bulged, and the veins in their tiny narrow foreheads beat in rage. One last time, they screamed, white power! The clown women thought they finally understood what the Klan was trying to say and said, oh, and the women clown said, now we understand, wife power. And they lifted the letters up in the air to say, W-I-F-E, power, grabbed the nearest male clowns and lifted them up in their arms and ran about merrily chanting, wife power, wife power, wife power. Apparently the clowns fundamentally misunderstood the nature of the rally. They believed it was a clown rally. Came in force to support their pointy, hated brethren. To their dismay, despite their best jokes and stunts and pratfalls, the Nazis and clans refused to laugh and indeed became enraged at the clowns. Clowns, on the other hand, had a great time. And finally, the Nazis and the KKK left, and the clowns then decided to march downtown, and the cops stopped the clowns and the counter-protesters. Hey, do you want an escort? An African-American police officer on a motorcycle asked. Yes, the clown replied. We're walking to Market Square in the center of town to celebrate. The police officers got in front of the now anti-racist parade and blocked the entire road for the march facilitating through to the heart of Knoxville. Oh, I'm sorry, this is Knoxville. An event called Imagination Station was taking place, and over 15,000 students and their parents were in town that weekend. Many of them cheered as the clowns, Knoxvillians, and counter-protesters marched through the heart of Knoxville, singing and laughing at the end of the Nazis' first attempt at having a rally in Knoxville. And so I had the city wrong. Asheville's in North Carolina, by the way. It's from the Asheville Indie Media. Jonathan in Taylor, Michigan. Hey, Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Tom, just, how you doing?
Good.
I was calling because that was an interesting story, too, you just told about the clowns in Asheville. But I was calling.
It's the power of satire, you know. It's incredible stuff.
Yeah, oh, man. Yeah, that was crazy. But I was calling because earlier you were talking about John Edwards, and you made a comment about how the national polls are misleading when you spend off about Ron Paul not doing as well in the national polls. And then you made a comment about how John Edwards is actually doing better, particularly in Iowa, than a lot of the other candidates. But I have a problem with that because I listen to a lot of the progressive talk people. I listen to the media. The media pushes Hillary Clinton, and I hear a lot of the progressive talk people pushing John Edwards. And everybody seems to talk about Obama as a side story. You know, either the progressive talk people mention Obama in the same vein as Hillary Clinton, and the media talks about Obama only in whatever kind of dichotomy or conflict they can set up, but nobody notes, like even you didn't note the fact that Barack Obama had just led in the last Iowa poll from ABC, and now, okay, John Edwards is leading, but not by a large margin. Barack Obama.
I didn't realize that Barack Obama had. Thanks for educating me on that, Jonathan.
I am
all in favor of Barack Obama, John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, Dennis Kucinich. Frankly, other than Mike Gravel, who's been on this program a couple of times, and I just think is a little too cranky to be president. Any of them, I think, are reasonable. I'm frankly more concerned with what we do than with what they do.
That's true. And I know you can't hold on to me very long, but one thing I want to say is I love your show, and I appreciate all your views. I just think you really should reconsider and at least look a little more in depth at what Obama says. Obama has just...
I have been. I have been, Jonathan, Obama, and I got to tell you, I understand that, and I've been rather frankly concerned by how militaristic and jingoistic Barack Obama has been sounding lately, as has Hillary Clinton, particularly with regard to Iran. And I haven't made it a big deal on this show because I really would rather, you know, hold up what I honor among the candidates rather than put down where the areas where I disagree with them.
Right.
But, you know, since you raised the issue, I'll tell you, that's why I have not been pushing Barack Obama. Is it concerns me that he seems to be swinging to the right to join in with the Republicans on the fear card, and I don't want to buy it.
That's a little misleading there, though. Well, the reason why I was going to say that is one about the whole Iran issue. You got to also take into account that John Edwards, when he did his little speech at AIPAC, he talked about Iran being a serious threat, and all options are on the table. So, look, all three top-tier candidates view Iran as a threat, and that's being disingenuous if you're saying that any one of those guys are not going to take a more aggressive posture towards Iran. No, they're not going to go out and bomb Iran like George Bush and Dick Cheney want to, but he does understand that Iran does pose some kind of a threat. It may not be as trumped up as the media is painting it out to be, but it does pose some kind of threat. And to say that he's coming off his right wing, that's kind of being disingenuous because, look, he obviously wants to go from his recent foreign policy speech. He wants to go into Afghanistan and finish the work that was done there. He wants to come out of Iraq like all the three top contenders do. And he wants to address the issue with Iran, not with the use of force, but by putting political pressure, like he just recently talked about maybe.
Well, again, I'm a supporter of Barack Obama's.
Absolutely.
Let me just, you know, make that very clear. I think Barack Obama would make a great president of the United States. And if he is the nominee of the party, I will vote for him and I will aggressively and enthusiastically campaign for him. You know, and right now I'm not specifically endorsing any of these folks in the primary.
Okay.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. But, you know, point made. 57 minutes past the hour. Up next is, well, stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
So, let's see. Leviticus 25 says that I may possess slaves, both male and female. However, they have to be purchased from neighboring nations, not from my own nation. I'm wondering if this applies to Canadians and Mexicans, or do I have to go outside of the hemisphere? Michael Chapman, the managing editor of the Cybercast News Service, the conservative news site, cnsnews.com, the website. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad to have you here with us. Randy Hall has written over at cnsnews.com an article about how in the California Supreme Court, apparently, legal briefs have been filed by Schwarzenegger and Jerry Brown suggesting that the word marriage doesn't have any specific legal significance under the California Constitution, and presumably, therefore, gay marriage can and should be legalized in California. Is that the logical extension of that logic?
I think that's the basic gist of the story. Our reporter was looking at, there were some briefs filed with the state Supreme Court there in California, and they're asking several questions. And one of them is, you know, what does the state constitution say about the definition of marry and the definition of marriage? And Governor Schwarzenegger and the Attorney General Jerry Brown submitted legal briefs basically arguing that from the way they read the constitution, that there is no clear-cut definition.
In other words, a clear-cut definition that specifies it must be a man and a woman.
Right. Basically, yeah.
Right. I mean, there are already laws. There are already laws against polygamy and bestiality and all the other sorts of weird things that Rick Santorum used to pull out of his hat, in his bizarre fantasies. But okay, so what's wrong with that? What's wrong with just like in Vermont? I mean, I was living in Vermont when the Vermont Supreme Court ruled that the Vermont Constitution, in fact, protects gay marriage or something similar to it. They ended up with civil unions because it has these anti-discrimination clauses in it from when Vermont abolished slavery the year before they became a state, when they were an independent republic.
Right. Well, before I respond to that, I want to make it clear that, I mean, when it comes to the news stories here at CNSnews.com, they're pretty much straight-up news stories, and you've pointed this out in the past, that we do our best to try to provide both sides of an issue and provide fairly balanced news reporting. And when you ask me a question about what's wrong with an issue, I'm talking to you as what would be our editorial position,
Right. I understand
on the editorial page of a newspaper, that's the editorial position of the paper.
No, and the editorial perspective of Cybercast News Service, CNSnews.com, is broadly conservative.
Wanted to make that distinction between our reporters and our
okay. So I'm asking you, Michael Chapman, as the managing editor in an editorial context, not a news context. What's wrong with gay marriage? I mean, the argument that is usually trotted out by people on the conservative side is that they believe that homosexual behavior is a sin, and that homosexuality therefore is sinful behavior and should not be sanctioned by marriage. That's the one argument. The other argument that is typically made is that, we've always done it this way. And I'm curious which of those, or if you've got some other argument, you guys are embracing these days.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily trot those out as my first argument, but I think they're certainly defensible by themselves. But, I would argue that what is the purpose of marriage? I mean, why do people get married? Why would a man and woman who fall in love get married? And I would argue that the purpose of marriage is to have children and to establish families with a mother and a father, a man and a woman, because the family, the traditional family as we've understood it throughout the centuries, between a man and a woman and their family, I mean, that is the cornerstone, the bedrock of Western civilization.
Okay, that raises two interesting questions. The first is, should we then say that anybody who is sterile is not allowed to get married?
No.
I mean, I've had a vasectomy. Should I now have my marriage to Louise annulled?
No. You're asking me, about marriage and the defense of marriage, and I'm just saying traditionally, and in my view, people get married largely to have children and to rear families.
And the
exceptions. And if you're saying, well, if I have a vasectomy and I don't want to have kids, or my wife for whatever reason, or we can't have children, that doesn't mean you should not get married. But I'm saying in general.
Well, we've already had three kids and they're all adults now, and thus the vasectomy, and some years ago. But the bottom line is, okay, we're past our childbearing age now, so should we unmarry?
No, because you're our parents and you will remain the parents of your children, until the day you die. And
okay, then what about the second point, which is that out of the 7,000 years of the institution of marriage, at least in the context of what you might call a biblical context, the Old and New Testament, going all the way back to Gilgamesh, which is arguably pre-biblical, marriage has been defined not as the union of one man and one woman. King David did not have one wife. King Solomon did not have one wife. David had, as I recall, 700 wives. The last time I was in Israel, we spent some time with a family that, where the husband legally had four wives. He was not Jewish. He was Muslim. But it's legal in Israel for Arabs to have up to four wives. And not just in Israel, in most of the countries in the Middle East. And historically, if you want to talk about the grand arc, the grand sweeping arc, I mean, even biblically, it is, marriage has been defined as the relationship between a man and a bunch of women.
Well,
That's certainly the case in Islam, and certainly in, you can cite some of the biblical passages, but I think there are certain theologians.
That's the case in Christianity and Judaism as well.
But wait. I mean, there are theologians who will argue about the definition about, you know, taking the literal statements in the Bible versus, you know, metaphoric or symbolic statements. And you mentioned 700 wives. I would have to talk to a theologian and a linguist and a translator to determine whether or not that is literally true, or, you know, or were there several wives. But I'm not going to defend polygamy. And I think over the years...
Yeah, I think we've already had that argument. But my point is that the definition of marriage has been very, very fluid. Up until the 1960s in the United States, if an African-American person and a Caucasian person wanted to get married, that marriage would not be legally recognized. It was not a marriage.
And that, I would agree with you. I would argue that that was wrong, that people of different races should certainly be allowed to marry. But my position is that marriage... traditionally and under Western civilization, and I'm not talking about, you know, Muslim dominant countries, and what may happen in the Far East, but marriage over the years has been institutionalized as largely between one man and one woman.
Just over the last few hundred years and just in some states. And beyond that, I mean, first of all, you said marriage is to have children.
I think the primary purpose is to have children, and the secondary purpose is the mutual support between the spouses.
Okay, so why can't gays support each other, and why can't gays adopt children? Or for that matter, if it's a female gay couple, one of them can become pregnant.
Gay couples who are attached to each other, I mean, can support each other. But homosexuality by itself, I mean, they cannot have children. They don't reproduce. I mean, man and woman have sexual
lesbians
organs
are
to produce children. Now homosexuals in certain states, I don't know all the laws across the nation. I mean, in certain cases are allowed to adopt children.
You're bringing yourself back to the argument, Michael, if you follow the logic of that would forbid people who are infertile or sterile from having children.
No, I wouldn't forbid people who are infertile or sterile from having children, but I would forbid homosexuals from having children or adopting children, because if you look, I mean, you can look at the scientific
because
studies
you
that
think,
have been done.
Because you think homosexuality is a sin.
Done, and looking at the traditional family, the man and the woman, and rearing children, I mean, these are the basic institutions that have proven over the years to be.
There have been a number of very competent studies done on the mental health of children raised in gay families, and it equals or exceeds the mental health of children raised in straight families. There are no studies that indicate that being raised in a gay family harms children. There are numerous studies that indicate that it helps children, and it massively, and I tell you, having worked in the child care industry for years, it massively helps children over being institutionalized or being in foster care.
Well, you know, we can do dueling studies. We've talked about this before, and I can go grab some folks at various other, you know, think tanks and institutions and scientists who have looked at this, and they will argue that if you want to have a good, stable family, you need a strong father and a strong mother, and you need to stay married regardless of how difficult things may be, and you work through the sacrifices and you try to make it work. Thank you.
Okay. Michael Chapman, Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com. Michael, can you stick around for just a minute? I'd like to, if you're willing to dig into this issue of sin with me for a moment.
Sure, I'll stay on, sure.
Okay, great. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Strange impulse out on the plains of West Texas. There's many a young boy who feels things he can't comprehend. And a small town don't like it when somebody falls between the sexes. No, a small town don't like it when a cowboy has feelings for men. And I believe to my soul that inside every man there's the feminine. And inside every lady there's a deep manly voice loud and clear. Well, the cowboy may brag about things that he's done with his women, but the ones that brag loudest are the ones that are most likely queer.
Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. You tell him, Willie Nelson. Michael Chapman is with us, the managing editor of the Cybercast News Service, CNSNews.com. And we are talking not about the news stories. We're talking about our particular editorial positions, Michael and I. And, Michael, welcome back, and thanks for sticking around.
Sure, Tom. Thanks.
I just wanted to put this in what I think is a reasonable context, and this is not for the purposes of just, you know, being absurd. It's actually serious. I'm assuming that you've spent some time with the Bible in your life.
Yeah.
I've read both the Old and New Testament four times, actually, word for word, front to back, and studied it at some length for a number of years, I can tell you that, first of all, Jesus never mentions homosexuality. Paul makes one reference to the number of wives somebody should have, and that's where, I believe it's in Romans, he says that a bishop in the church should be of good standing and have only a single wife. And and then later on he says, speaking for himself, that he would rather not be married at all, not be distracted from spiritual matters. And that is what led to the Catholic priests being celibate. In large part.
Mm-hmm.
But and homosexuality is condemned in the Old Testament, not in the New Testament. And in the Old Testament, it's condemned in Leviticus, Leviticus 18:22. It says that, you know, it's an abomination. But there are other things as well. I know I mentioned originally Exodus 21:7. It says that you can sell your daughter into slavery as long as you get a fair price for her. I mean, in Leviticus 15, it says that to touch a woman when she's having her menstrual period is a crime. In Leviticus 25, it talks about how it's perfectly legal to possess slaves, both male and female, as long as you don't purchase them from within your own state. Exodus 35 talks about how somebody who works on the Sabbath must be put to death.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm guessing that, you know, like me, you've probably worked on the Sabbath. And there's more. I mean, you know, it's
well, if I could just jump in here. I mean, it's a good issue to talk about. Because, I mean, I'm going to tell you, I'm a Catholic. And for Catholics, I mean, there are differences when we talk about the Bible. For example, if I'm talking with an evangelical Protestant fundamentalist who tends to take the Bible very literally, word for word. In Catholicism, we don't take the Bible literally, word for word, in every single instance. Some cases we do, and some cases we don't.
Well, I would say even evangelical Protestants don't, having been one myself for a number of years, and now just I call myself more of a plain vanilla Christian, but
sure.
but I can tell you, you know, evangelical Protestants are not like the Hasidim, are not saying, I will not wear clothing made of two different types of fabric because it says in Leviticus that that's a crime. They're ignoring. I mean, there's 635 laws in Leviticus and that are followed by some people, by some highly Orthodox Jews, for example,
sure,
that are ignored by the vast majority, by all evangelical Protestants.
Okay. Well, my point was that when it comes to reading the Bible and playing what I sometimes refer to as scriptural badminton with people when we argue, is that as a Catholic, I mean, we look at the Bible. We have to look at it very carefully, and we have a catechism that has been gone over by theologians over the years and experts who deal with translations of the Bible and study these things and come to conclusions.
I understand,
on the Bible.
Michael.
So when you're asking me
I'm
about
sorry to interrupt you, but
the Old Testament, you know, I'm not going to take a position on a specific instance about working on the Sabbath or, you know, slavery and something like that until I consult what my church authorities say, you know, exactly what this means and how it applies to this world.
But we're talking about making this stuff into law.
But no. In certain cases, you can. For example, the church and Christianity, not just Catholics, but Protestants, for example, have done a lot who did a lot to end slavery in this country and in other countries. I mean, John Brown and the abolitionists were Christians.
Absolutely.
And
I'm not disagreeing with you. And that's where I'm saying, you know, in religion, we pick and choose. And
sure.
Should we be using religious doctrines to pick and choose our laws? I think not.
But I think you can argue in some cases, whether it's slavery and whether it's marriage and other some of these solid basic things, you can look at the religious arguments and you can apply them to state law. We do that against, we don't have murder. You can't kill.
We didn't have murder before Christianity.
No, but
your point
law.
Is well made, Michael. Michael, I'm sorry,
law.
We're out of time, but I got it. Your point is well made. Thank you. CNSNews.com, Michael Chapman, the managing editor. Michael, I really appreciate your sticking around.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, toll free all across the United States. At the top of TomHartman.com, by the way, a link to our C-SPAN show from last Friday if you'd like to see what the show looks like. It's an entertaining view. And also the blog, our blog over at the Tom Hartman page at AirAmerica.com. Drop by and say hi. 1-866-303-2270. Scott in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Scott.
Hi there, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And thanks for sharing your wealth of knowledge with us all and giving us a forum to express ourselves like this. Regarding the previous conversation, I just don't understand why people like Michael care about gay marriage. At the outset, I have to say I have a gay brother that's in a committed relationship. They were married in a public Jewish wedding, traditional Jewish wedding. They've been together for over 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line for me is that it's in society's interests to have people in long-term committed relationships.
I agree. I had an uncle who lived with another man for over 40 years, maybe over 50 years. I mean, for a long, long time. And great guy, and a wonderful relationship. And it's I don't get it either. I just don't get it. Why would, other than religious reasons? And if it's going to be religious reasons, there's two issues. One, we pick and choose what we're going to take out of the Bible and decide to enforce or not enforce. I mean, there's places in this world where particularly in Jerusalem, I'm forgetting the name of the community, but where if you drive on Sabbath, they will come out and throw stones at you. I mean, you know, there's the Seventh-day Adventists in the United States, Christians are very, very worried about working on the Sabbath, and the Saturday is the Sabbath for Seventh-day Adventists. I mean, people pick and choose what they're going to enforce, and then that leads to the question of, at what point do we allow religion to bleed over into statecraft? And to talk about, for example, murder, I mean, of the Ten Commandments, there are only two, arguably three, that are law in the United States. And you know, it's not against the law to disrespect your parents. It's not against the law to worship another, a different god. And so I'm very concerned about this contamination and how it spreads across. And
of course,
Scott,
and if it's a religion, then the solution, as I see it, is that people like him shouldn't marry people of the same sex.
Yeah, if he doesn't like it. Yeah, exactly. And if his church doesn't want to recognize them, that's fine. His church can just like the Catholic Church has said that Rudy Giuliani isn't legally married right now. I believe that they have said that. If they haven't, they certainly should, because the Catholic Church says that, you know, once you've had sex, you know, after you're married, that's it. Period. You're stuck with that person for the rest of your life. And you can't get an annulment, and Rudy's on what, number three, they're absolutely, Scott, and let the civil laws promote the security and safety of people in committed relationships, and let religions have their own religious rules. God bless them. Let them, you know, whatever, whichever way they want to go. But carving it into law is a whole different thing. Will in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Will.
Tom, I've been listening to you since before Air America even existed. It's an honor to finally speak with you.
Well, thank you, Will.
The reason I'm calling is to show appreciation for Michael that he finally admitted what conservatives have been hiding for years about their attitudes, not just towards marriage, but about sex. It's all about making babies. They don't approve of birth control. They don't approve of abortion. They don't approve of sex education because to them, marriage and sex is all about having kids. And he can finally admit that. And if you look at a lot of the rhetoric that the conservatives talk about, they dance around it a little bit, but it's all about marriage is for making babies. Forget about love and companionship and all that stuff. It's about reproducing, propagating.
Yeah, and you know, there's actually a rational basis for that way back in history. I mean, there was a time, arguably 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago, when the Bible was being written and the stories were being told, where the tribe with the largest number of people in it, and thus the largest army, was the tribe that survived. And there are a lot of tribes that didn't survive, period. You know, they have no ancestors left. And so all of us are the descendants, ultimately, of people who were in tribes that survived. And many of those tribes survived by virtue of outpopulating and thus outmilitarizing other tribes that were competing for the same resources. So you could argue, even though it might not be morally right, you can argue that there was some sort of evolutionary and adaptive asset associated with marriage, particularly with multiple wives or whatever's going to produce the largest number of children, and with patriarchy and all that kind of stuff, that at some point in human history that had some sort of adaptive value. But I would say that with 6.5 billion people on the planet right now, not only does it not have an adaptive value, it has become unadaptive. It has become maladaptive.
Exactly. And any divorce lawyer will tell you that the dissolution of a marriage is a dissolution of property. Marriage is a property right.
Right. And marriage is a contract, basically, at the civil level.
Yeah, exactly. And looking at some of the opinions at the Supreme Court of Washington and the High Court in New York, when they struck down gay marriage, they said marriage is for preserving children. As a matter of fact, the New York opinion said one of the reasons straight people need marriage and gay people don't is that gay people are less likely to have kids by accident, and the shotgun marriage, forcing a couple to get together for the sake of the kids, is good for society, according to the highest court in New York.
Which brings us back then to the reductio ad absurdum, or however you say that in Latin, you know, taking this argument to its logical extreme, is that anybody who's not capable of having children should not be able to legally be married. Will, excellent point. Thank you very, very much for the call. TJ in Denver. Hey, TJ.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
I was just going to say that, you know, my wife was actually raised by a couple of lesbian mothers. She's, you know, the most well-adjusted person I've ever known. I myself was raised by an abusive father, you know, drugs, alcohols, all, you know, the whole nine yards, the whole gamut. And, you know, talking about our the way we were raised, I really don't see a problem with, you know, gays raising kids. I mean,
your point that there is a whole lot of things that are more important to a child than whether his parents are straight or gay. Like, for example, are his parents, you know, do they have a functional marriage? Are they rational people? Are they not abusive? You know, things like this. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
Well said, TJ. Thank you very much. It's important stuff. Will in Palm Springs, California. Hey, Will.
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for bringing this subject up again. I feel like the whole country has just spent way too much time making this a divisive issue. But my comment is more about the Larry Craig story and the way that the media has portrayed this story. Larry Craig's fall from grace is not a story about gay anything. It's a story about a self-loathing, sexually repressed hypocrite.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And most gay, and it needs to be said over and over and over again, that most gay men do not look for anonymous sex. Most gay men are not in men's rooms any more than most heterosexual men are cruising.
Self-respecting, open-minded, honest-living gay people do not have sex in bathrooms, period.
Right.
They just right. don't have to do it. And that ties into your whole marriage thing, because if human sexuality, all sexualities, were not repressed so much, then people wouldn't have to resort to this kind of behavior.
Larry Craig is a victim of the very hypocrisy that the Republican Party is promoting back in the 1950s, in the era when he grew up. Absolutely right, Will. And I think I've told the story on this program. I know I did on the morning show beforehand, that back when I was 17, 18, when Louise and I were dating, actually, and I was working as a DJ in Lansing, Michigan, I used to, on the weekends, DJ the drag show at Joe Covello's bar, the local gay bar. And, you know, and used their men's room. And I never got, nobody ever hit on me in the men's room there. And it was actually one of our favorite things to do. Louise and I would go dance at the, it was great fun. I mean, we're all just people here is the bottom line. It's not like people who are gay are somehow profoundly different from people who are straight. We're all just people. And that's the story that we need to be communicating. Jim in New York City. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom. Two things. First off, should Elizabeth Dole and Bob Dole be married? They married later in life, past procreation age. Should they be married?
That's my point. If the purpose of marriage is to have children, then Bob and Elizabeth should annul their marriage.
And should these couples that sleep in separate bedrooms, should they be married? I know a lot of friends' parents who sleep in separate bedrooms. And also, this isn't about changing religious doctrine. Gay marriage is about civil unions. This has nothing to do with the church. If the churches don't want gays to marry, fine, no problem. This is about a civil issue. This is nothing.
You're absolutely right. And the problem with the phrase civil unions, and we saw this in Vermont. I used to live in Vermont up until about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago. And the problem is that the word marriage is in so many laws, in so many states, and in so many federal statutes that I don't think that civil unions is enough. I think that we need to use the word marriage and use it in its civil meaning, and let religious people and let churches and synagogues and mosques and whatever define marriage however they want and say whether or not they will recognize it, just like the Catholic Church has done forever, you know, that they cease to recognize the marriage of people who have not gone through the annulment process, for example, you know, divorcees. And you know, let the religious folks deal with it at the level of religion, but at the level of civil contract, then we need to allow people to have a contract that says that they're going to be able to share property, they're going to be able to visit each other in the hospital, they're going to be able to have that relationship in a way that is recognized by all of us legally to enjoy those benefits of long-term commitment. I mean, it's just really simple stuff. This is not rocket science. And this is why I'm frankly concerned about the whole civil unions thing. We need to call it marriage. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring, bound by wild desire. I fell into a ring of fire.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Keith in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. You want to disagree with me, Keith? Great. You go to the front of the line. What's up?
Well, Tom, I just wanted to be clear. Are you in favor of overturning polygamy laws in the United States?
Let's consider this for just a second, Keith, if we can rationally have a conversation
sure.
about this in the context of society and society's needs.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather
do it in terms of principle.
Well, I think that society's needs is a really important principle, and polygamy came about.
You're rationalizing already, Tom, and you know it.
You haven't let me finish a sentence here, Keith. Polygamy came about because there were, and if you look across societies, and there's a number of very good anthropological studies on this. Polygamy exists in warlike societies. In societies where a large percentage of the men die off in wars, you have a disproportionate number of women, and polygamy emerges as a way of making sure that everybody has at least, you know, one or two or three partners, but everybody gets paired up. And it maximizes the probability of there being children and the tribe growing and expanding. We are not, well, I guess we are right now with the war in Iraq, but by and large, we are not a warlike society in the United States. And Western civilization, for that matter, has not been war-driven for at least 400 or 500 years, maybe arguably 1,000 years, like it was 3,000 years ago in the Middle East when polygamy was very common. And in some places where polygamy still is common around the world, in some warlike tribes. So I would submit to you that polygamy no longer has any kind of social value. That
yes,
we have roughly equal numbers of men and women. And so polygamy, you know, and therefore, no, I'm not in favor of rolling back the laws against polygamy.
You understand the problem there. That what you're doing is you're picking and choosing who gets their freedom and who doesn't. That a religious Muslim living in the United States can't follow in concert with two or three women that want to marry him. You're saying they shouldn't be able to do that in your society as you think it should be.
I realize that, and I realize the hypocrisy of that, Keith, and I'll give you that.
Hypocritical.
Yep. I'll give you that. Let me finish the sentence here. You may be able to convince me to support it, but you would have to convince me first that it's not exploitative of women, because that's my other objection to polygamy is.
These are adult women, and you're going to decide whether they're going to be exploited or not.
Right.
You
okay.
See, this is the hypocrisy. Of you deciding what's good for other people and enforcing, but we can't decide that gay marriage isn't good for society, but we can decide that polygamy is not.
Well, my point was that if in a society where you have a disproportionate number of men to women because it's a warlike society, polygamy makes, anthropologically, sociologically, it makes a certain amount of sense. And in a society where you've got 6.5 billion people on the planet, having relationships, committed long-term relationships, which are not based on breeding children, makes a lot of sense. You know, when John Kennedy was sworn in as president, there were half as many people, fewer than half as many people on the planet as there are today. When this country was founded, there was 1/6 as many people on the planet as there are today. And the world was not overpopulated when we fought the Revolutionary War. So, you know, I would say that if we're still saying that the purpose of marriage is to produce more children, that, you know, we're going down a disastrous road. But you're absolutely right, Keith. I agree with you that to say, okay, here we're going to arbitrarily, I'm going to, in my infinite wisdom, I'm going to arbitrarily say somebody should be able to have one wife or one husband rather than two or three, that there is a level of hypocrisy there. But I'll tell you, the reason that I'm taking that position is that, frankly, I just don't think that our society, and this is the same argument the conservatives take, and so I'll tell you right up front, this is my hypocrisy as well. You know, I don't think our society is ready to go there, although there's a bunch of Mormons out in Utah who want to go there, you know, and they're making TV shows about them. But anyway.
I appreciate your honesty with that, Tom. I'm afraid, and I listen, I'm a stay-at-home dad. I listen to you in the morning, and I listen to Rush in the afternoon. And just because it's fun, political radio for me. But
sure.
we are in a society in which both progressives and conservatives are doing their damnedest to inflict their values on the other side. Instead of us agreeing to disagree, and conservatives live in red states and progressives live in blue states, and we each pass our own laws regarding all this stuff.
Yeah, see, I don't think that's how the Civil War came about, Keith. And really,
yes.
I don't think that there's anything such thing as a red or blue state. They're all pretty purple. You know, there is no state where you find, you know, majorities that are greater than 60% for all practical purposes.
Well,
Republican
I've lived in
or Democrat.
Massachusetts and Texas, and right. I can tell you the cultural divide is incredible between the two. And
oh sure, sure, absolutely. Have you did you ever read that book, The Six or Seven Nations of America, that was popular back in the 1970s? It was an amazing study. You know, he pointed out that the Rust Belt, for example, where I grew up in the Midwest in Michigan, has a completely different culture from California, and California has a different culture from the Pacific Northwest, and the Pacific Northwest has a different culture from Tex-Mex, and arguably we are seven different nations, you know, scattered among these states, but there's these regional differences. I agree. I absolutely agree.
And we accuse each other of having no values when in fact we just have different values.
Well, I don't think
and,
I've
and
accused anybody of having
part.
No values, Keith. I don't think that you will ever hear me accusing anybody of having no values. My point is that I think that it's time for us to expand the definition of what we're not going to discriminate against, expand civil rights in this country to include gays. It's just,
I think we'll wind up doing that. The country just isn't quite ready to take that step yet. And unfortunately, it's cost Democrats 2 elections. Now, I'm a libertarian, but it's cost you 2 elections.
Yeah, well, you know, I think it was Brownback said to Ron Paul last night, sometimes doing what's right is more important than doing what's politically expedient. And, oddly enough, I'll support that position.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. Oh, my. And speaking of population, Edward Hartman, no relation, is going to be up next talking about the Population Fix, thepopulationfix.com. After that, we're going to have Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress, News Under the Radar. After that, we're going to have our Best of the Rest of the News segment, and then Talk Radio News is going to be with us at the end of the hour. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
So how many is too many and how many is not enough? Welcome back, by the way, to the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. TomHartman.com, our website if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com, if you want to participate in our blog for the day. And you'll find also links to our message boards over at TomHartman.org. And a whole bunch of interesting websites floating around. How many is too many? How many Americans is too many Americans? How many Americans is enough Americans? There's this meme going around, this thought virus that has been flogged pretty enthusiastically, pretty heavily. I've seen articles in the Wall Street Journal on several occasions. I saw one in the New York Times last year. And certainly The Economist wrote a piece about this, about how countries like Japan are seeing their populations and Italy are seeing their populations shrink because they have zero population growth or negative population growth, or their populations are aging and it's a terrible thing and they're having to import people. Russia is now paying people to have babies. Should we be doing that in the United States? What's the future bring? Or are we thinking about this entirely wrong? Edward Hartman is with us. He's the author, and no relation to me. He's the author of The Population Fix, the website thepopulationfix.com. But the book is The Population Fix, Breaking America's Addiction to Population Growth. Edward, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So the anti-Malthusians, I don't know how else to characterize them, tell us that if our population isn't continuously growing, then we're going to be in terrible trouble because we're not going to have enough people to work in the factories and we're not going to have enough people to take care of all of us. Out of us old farts as we get older and older. There won't be enough to pay the taxes for retirement, et cetera, et cetera. What's wrong with that logic?
Well, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of arguments that people can make as to why the population should continue growing forever. But common sense and mathematics tells us that's not possible. And so consequently, if we've got a system, and I don't think we do, but if we have a system that insists that we have to have more and more babies, more and more people, then we can tell ourselves that eventually we're going to be in such a crowded condition that nobody will enjoy the fruits of all this increased population and the economic benefits that supposedly go along with it. China obviously decided a long time ago, not soon enough, but a long time ago, that 1 billion people was not a good idea. Unfortunately, they had about 700 million people when they made that decision, and now, despite all that they've done, their one-child policy, so-called, they now are approaching 1.4 billion. Mm-hmm. India, the same situation. Probably when they were in the 600 million level, they decided they had to start doing something, giving transistor radios away for vasectomies, for example. Now they've got 1.2 billion people and growing. They're expected to pass China someday. So none of the countries which have had the experience of having
600 million and 700 million people have decided it was a good experience. They're
right.
Not.
And China's experience, actually, I mean, the decision was made in large part after the famines of the 1960s. And didn't like 34 million people die of starvation in China in the early 60s?
You could be right. I don't know that number, but you could very well be right.
Yeah, that's my recollection. I mean, I was fairly young at the time, but I remember, you know, mom, eat your food. There's children dying in China. And it was actually in the news all the time, you know.
Sure.
So, right now, Russia is actually paying, for all practical purposes, a bounty to have children. Here in the United States, we give tax subsidies to have children. It's called a tax deduction. There are other countries that are doing the same. There are people who suggest that if we're not going to have children, we need to increase our rates of immigration. We need a continuous influx of young people to do the jobs that only young people can do. How do you argue with that?
Well, in the first place, the young people become old people, and the old people go on Social Security, and so then you need more and more young people to support the more and more old people.
That's the argument the other side makes. What's your response to it?
Well, my response is just what I've said. A Ponzi scheme by any other name is still a Ponzi scheme, and that's what Social Security is. If we rely on more and more people to support the retirees, then ultimately you say that there has to be infinite growth in the population. And common sense tells us we cannot stand infinite growth. At some point, it has to stop.
So what is the solution?
Well, the solution is for people to start thinking about it. That's the number one solution. You've got to start looking at the crowds that you see on the freeways. You've got to start looking at the crowded schools. You've got to start looking at the bankrupt hospitals and the clinics that are closing, the emergency rooms that are shutting down. You've got to look at the pollution in the air, the pollution in the water. You've got to look at all of these problems that mainstream media tells us about but never bothers to connect the dots between those problems and our perpetual and accelerating population growth. And
if Bill McKibben wrote a book called One is Enough, as I recall, and in fact, I talked with him shortly after that. My recollection is it was on this radio program maybe 5 years ago, and he and his wife have decided to only have one child because they're very committed to this idea of negative population growth in the United States, that it would be a good thing, that we, you know, that we're a nation now of what, about 315 million, as I recall, and when John Kennedy was inaugurated, we were a nation of 200 and some odd million. Mm-hmm. During the Great Depression, we were a little over 100 million. I mean, we have seen a really huge increase in the population just of the United States.
That's right.
And many would argue that along with that increase in population, we've seen a steady deterioration of the quality of life. But on the other hand, if you look back at Europe, for example, look at after the Black Plague wiped out a third of Europe, the quality of life for the four or five generations after that dramatically increased. I mean, that was the first, that's what led to the Renaissance. That was the first middle class that emerged in Europe, you know, in over 1,000 years. We don't want to bring about the Black Plague here. I mean, you know, so are you suggesting that we should just start letting the steam out, that we should be arguing in favor of not having as many children? I mean, just the bottom line that we should set population targets for the United States and around the world as well?
I think that as individuals, we should be thinking about population targets for the United States. And I think we should be passing that thought along, our thoughts along to our elected representatives. There have been a whole host of commissions and committees and intelligence studies over the last 40 or 50 years, and everyone has come back to the same conclusion. Number one, there is no indication that population growth is necessary for environmental growth. And number two, that there are both security and social risks in continuing this perpetual and accelerating population growth.
But what about the argument that population growth is necessary for economic growth?
Well, this is what every commission and every study that either Congress or an administration has asked for has come back with a conclusion that there is no such connection. And if you stop and think about it, think about some of the Middle Eastern countries, Bahrain and Dubai and those stations. Did their population increase to make them so wealthy? No, they found oil underground. And likewise, if we have a place in a little remote island with 1,000, population of 1,000. And if it has enough arable land to provide food for 1,000 people, and it has enough clothing, flora and fauna to provide clothing for 1,000 people, and it has enough timber to house 1,000 people, and if some smart person comes along and figures out a way to make clothing and grow food and make houses with less labor, improves the economy, they have more time for talk radio and reading books, the economy improves, the population hasn't changed. So there, there is no connection. Meanwhile,
so in fact, as our population declines, our quality of life would improve because the resource to population ratio would tilt in the direction of there being more resources for the smaller population. The per person wealth would increase.
Absolutely correct. And I've used the expression a perpetual and accelerating population growth in this country. Let me illustrate it, if I may.
Yeah, we just have about a half a minute here.
Okay. We've had population growth 105 of the last 106 years. And the population increased in the first half of the 20th century by 76 million, but it increased by 130 million during the second half. If that perpetual and accelerating population growth continues through the 21st century, we will have a population of 880 million people.
Yeah, and then we'll start looking, our big cities will start looking like Bogota and Mexico City with huge slums. And yeah, I've been in those places. I've worked in those places. And that ain't how we want this country to be. Edward Hartman, thepopulationfix.com, the website, The Population Fix, the book. Edward, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program on Air America Radio. And up next, Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, about what's flying under the news radar today.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Believe in magic. I'll tell you right up front. Welcome back. And one of the most magical organizations out there is the Center for American Progress. They're doing some absolutely great work. One of the magical people there, Christy Harvey with AmericanProgress.org. Hey, Christy.
Hello. How are you?
Just great. Great to have you on. The Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., AmericanProgress.org, the website. And Christy, what do you see as the news flying under the radar today?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you, it turns out you're very good luck. Last time I talked to you, I hung up the phone, walked outside, and caught my very first fish. So it was very exciting.
You walked outside in downtown Washington, D.C.? What, a fish come flying down the street?
Basically, no. It was in a work retreat. I was calling you from Annapolis, and I'd caught fish before, but never through fly fishing. So the two instances are connected in my mind.
Okay, well, congratulations.
But I've also caught some stories that I hope that you've seen, but there's some interesting stuff going on out there. The first is the National Security Archive today filed a lawsuit. They're suing the White House, which is...
Now, the National Security Archive is a branch of Congress, is it not?
It is, yes.
Like the GAO?
It is, yes. And they're basically the historians who are in charge of making sure that, you know, a few years down the road, we'll be able to see what happened in what White House and that sort of thing. And they're suing the White House because the White House basically used to have an automatic archiving system for all of its emails. And we know now that they abandoned that in 2002, you know, basically right when they came on board, and they never replaced it. And that in part has led to this loss of those 5 million emails between March of 2003 and October of 2005.
This makes Rosemary Woods look like a piker. I mean, she was able to excise 18 and a half minutes from one of Nixon's tapes, but we're talking about an entire first presidential term. All of the email records that involved the senior officials in the White House. This is like the mafia. I mean, you know, they're covering their tracks.
It's omerta, I believe, is the proper word.
Yeah,
they're trying to erase any record of anything that they've done that they could get busted for down the road.
And is this an impeachable offense?
It's interesting because earlier this week, Henry Waxman, the mustache of justice, is on the trail of all of these emails and said, okay, how did this happen? And the White House said, we had this outside contractor who was supposed to be saving these emails, and they didn't. And Henry Waxman said, okay, what's the name of that contractor? And the White House said, we can't tell you. And Henry Waxman said, why? And the White House said, we can't tell you that either. So it's really, really shady. And I don't usually go in for the conspiracies, but this is definitely something is being hidden, and they're trying to keep something out of the public eye.
Yeah, big time. Big time.
Big time.
That's incredible. With regard to the casualty stories, another one of the big stories that I'm seeing out here right now is that the Petraeus report and the surge is working, and et cetera, et cetera. But it seems that they're going to some lengths to doctor these numbers, aren't they?
They really are, and you'll hear, especially next week when General Petraeus gives his report, we're going to start hearing numbers all over the map. And General Petraeus likes to come out and say, you know, oh, casualties are down 75% since last December, and it turns out that is absolutely not true. And there's been some really fuzzy math at the Pentagon on what they count as a casualty. And there's a very good case in point from the Washington Post today that, for example, they can say that sectarian violence is down depending on what they classify as sectarian violence. And as one general put it, if a bullet goes through the back of your head, it's sectarian violence. If it goes through the front of your head, it's considered criminal and not counted.
Wow. Now, I understand also car bombs are now considered to be car accidents.
Car bombs are car accidents, yes. And also, they can cook the books with sectarian violence, where they say that if it's one member of a sect killing another member of the sect, like we've seen a lot of Sunni on Sunni violence and Shia on Shia violence, especially in the South, that doesn't count either. Those deaths are just magically disappeared. They
right.
just are not registered anywhere. So if you don't count the violence, of course it's easy to say that your numbers have gone down.
Yeah, it's like saying if you don't count yellow taxis, there are no taxis in New York City.
Precisely.
And we just have about a half a minute left here, Christy. Data mining, a lot of fanfare. The Department of Homeland Security is stopping an illegal data mining program. Are they just stopping the part of it that has been outed as illegal?
No, they're actually going to hold up on the entire data mining thing because it turns out that there were 171 performance expectations, and the Department of Homeland Security were not able to even meet any of them. And it turns out that in the data mining, investigators found out they were testing it on real people and not using any security measures.
Right. So not only was it done illegally, not only was it done in an insecure fashion, but it didn't work.
Right.
Amazing. Christy Harvey, Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Christy, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Time for our best of the rest of the news segment. First, I just wanted to let you know, just waving my own flag, I guess, but it's kind of a cool thing. Project Censored has just officially announced the publication of Project Censored 2008, and their Project Censored, their the top censored stories of 2008, the top 25 censored stories of 2008, and their Project Censored Awards. And I have just won my fourth Project Censored Award. It's the number one story. Robert Perry and I shared, actually, the number one position, piece that he wrote about habeas corpus, and a piece I wrote called Repeal the Military Commissions Act and Restore the Most Human American Human Right. So it's kind of a cool thing. You can check it out over at projectcensored.org. But now, time for our best of the rest of the news segment, where we go out to the tubes, not the trucks, out to the Internet and find out what people are talking about in the Internetosphere, or blogger, whatever you want to call it. And we have with us today Steve Rendell?
That's right.
Steve Rendell of Fair.org, Fair's senior analyst and the co-host of its national radio show Counterspin, and you can find that over at Fair.org. And Nancy Scola, who is the official blogger over at AirAmerica.com. Hey, Nancy.
Hey, Tom.
And who's in our studios in New York, so you sound like you're right here with us. And I should say to all of our folks who are participating in the blog over at AirAmerica.com, you know, drop in and say hi to Nancy and her blog on the front page and say something nice to her. You know, to make her feel good about being here. And the same same with Steve as well. Steve, let's start with you over at Fair.org. You're watching the media coverage. What do you see as the major stories as they have to do with how they're being covered by the media, or how they're not being covered by the media, for that matter?
Well, I think the surge is a big story. People are beating their chests and saying they have scoops, getting David Petraeus to General Petraeus to submit to interviews in advance of his report next week. We don't quite understand why that would be a hot story now. Presumably, he's not going to give out the meat of a report that's due next week. But one of the things that we found in this reporting, Howard Fineman of Newsweek has done this, and Carl Hulse in the New York Times today repeated the same inaccuracy, pointing out, for instance, Hulse said today in the Times that senior Democrats now say they are willing to rethink their push to establish a withdrawal deadline of next spring if doing so will attract the 60 Senate votes needed to prevail. Democrats would need to lure the 60 senators in order to cut off the likely Republican filibuster. Well, this is something we've corrected the press on many times, but one more time, the Democrats do not need 60 votes to make the U.S. withdraw from Iraq. They just need to refrain from passing a bill that gives more money for Iraq.
Right, they only need 40 votes,
41, actually. 41 votes, yes.
41 votes, yeah.
So we've corrected this so many times that we're getting kind of tired of it, but there's some slow learners out there in the media.
Yeah, well, for sure. And I'm curious also, Steve, since we're talking about the media, did you see the Republican debates on Fox News last night?
I saw a good chunk of them. I thought they were wildly entertaining.
Yeah, it was some interesting theater. One of the things that I noticed, and in fact, I got an email from a friend who just a few minutes ago commenting on this as well, and so apparently I wasn't the only one who noticed it, was that whenever Ron Paul was speaking, first of all, Sean Hannity off camera was laughing at him.
I know where you're going.
And the other thing was that when he would speak, they would do split screens where they'd show Rudy Giuliani with this incredulous look on his face. And this is a way of essentially ridiculing the guy and diminishing his credibility. And the very clear anti Ron Paul bias. And I'm no fan of Ron Paul politically. I mean, I respect the guy for at least having a set of principles that he lives by politically and apparently personally. But we're on opposite ends of the political spectrum. But nonetheless, the Republican Party and Fox News really want to have nothing to do with him. Your thoughts on that?
I think you should expect no more from Fox News, but I think what's happening here is they remembered that first time around in one of those, at least maybe it was the first debate, but an early debate where Giuliani, the media said, not just Fox News, it was pretty much a media-wide thing, that Giuliani really shut up Ron Paul over the 9/11. And in fact, the media in purveying that myth at the time really got it wrong. Ron Paul was actually correct, but Rudy Giuliani got credit. So I think Fox News saw that and thinks that ridiculing him, singling him out for ridicule among really a ridiculous panel.
In fact, that one question that they asked him, so you think that we should take our foreign policy cues from Al Qaeda?
Yeah.
And he said, no, I take my foreign policy cues from the Constitution. But the fact of the matter is that in invading Iraq, we did do exactly what Al Qaeda wanted.
Yeah, exactly.
And a point that wasn't made in the debates that I was waiting for Ron Paul to say that. Nancy Scola, the official blogger over at AirAmerica.com. Nancy, in the blogs and out in the blogosphere, what are you hearing and seeing? What sense do you get of the big stories that people care about right now?
Well, Tom, I think that one of the stories that hasn't gotten as much attention as maybe it should have in this time of Larry Craig and the surge, it's definitely a busy week down in Washington. It's going to be a busy 2 weeks. Is that Congress is almost ready to take up electronic voting reform, which is a subject I believe you've done some work on in the past. And it's been a long time coming. It's been at least 3 years since people have been aggressively working to do some sort of reform of electronic voting machines. These are, of course, the voting machines made by companies like Diebold or ESNS that were sort of put into place after the 2000 debacle in that presidential election by the Help America Vote Act. And I think, you know, we all sort of well know the problem, know well the problems with these machines. And this bill, it's Bill 811. It was introduced by Representative Rush Holt of New Jersey. It's called the Voter Confidence and Increased Accessibility Act of 2007. And this was sort of the great white hope of voting reform advocates. And in sort of the genius of Congress, they've managed to come up with a bill that no one likes.
I don't. I certainly don't. In fact, Rush Holt himself said, you know, Microsoft got in and lobbied and their lobbying was heard. And I'm like, what? Microsoft? I mean, we've got legislation being written by corporations. I mean, obviously most of our legislation is written by corporations these days and it's wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. Holt has actually come out and said remarkably, he said, it's no longer my bill. Which is sort of an interesting thing for the co-sponsor to say. And he's still going to bring it to the floor either later this afternoon or tomorrow. But as I said, there's the provisions that people were really hoping would do something about the electronic voting problem were pulled out in committee. The one that Microsoft sort of, you know, drew the ire of Microsoft was opening up these machines so that we could take a look at the proprietary code that they run on. And remarkably, I don't know how many people know this, but we can't take a look at it. Even though the federal government pays a lot of money for it, even though state and local election officials pay a lot of money for these machines, we have no right to see how they run. Some of them run on Windows, which is part of the problem here. And Microsoft came into the committee and said, you know what, we need to get rid of that provision. So that was pulled.
Yeah, this is a piece of legislation that, in my opinion, should be defeated. I know that there are some people, there's a small minority of the kind of anti-voting machine crowd, shall we call it, or people who are concerned with electronic voting and have been for years, who are saying, well, no, it's a good piece of legislation. I respectfully disagree with them, and I know that Mark Crispin Miller and Brad Friedman and many of Bev Harris and many of us who have been working on this and writing about it, I mean, I've been writing about this for 5 years now, just feel that this is a bad piece of legislation. When Rush Holt first introduced it, he was a guest on this program back almost 5 years ago. And I said to him, this is the beating heart of democracy. Why are we outsourcing it? Why should we allow private corporations to have any proprietary rights over our vote?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It stumped him. It just stumped him. He was at that point. He was like, well, I don't know.
I think this is a situation sort of the more you dig into it, the more remarkable it seems. The way that we were verifying some of these systems in the past was we would ship them out to third party laboratories and get some sort of seal of approval. When Congress started looking into these laboratories, they were, you know, in folks' basements. There was really sort of no oversight over these machines at all.
And Dan Rather did a great expose on just even the manufacture of the machines. And we had him on the program a while ago talking about that. Steve Rendell. Rendell.
That's it.
Rendell, yeah, of Fair.org, the senior analyst over at Fair. What are the stories, Steve, that you're seeing that you think are on the future, on the horizon, the stories that we really aren't talking about right now that are probably going to blow up in our faces we should be talking about?
I'm working on Giuliani's Teflon. He makes Ronald Reagan look vulnerable. Giuliani, of course, as I'm sure your listeners know, has employees, a longtime friend of his, a childhood friend of his, who is a former Monsignor and priest who a Suffolk County grand jury here in New York found has had not only molested children himself, but had also covered up the molestations of other priests in his charge. The only reason he was not indicted is that the statute of limitations ran out. This Monsignor's a lawyer, and he specialized in stalling cases.
This is like Giuliani's association with Bernie Kerik. Steve,
yeah.
we only have 30 seconds left. I want to get the same question into Nancy Scola before we're out of time. Nancy, what do you see on the horizon that we should be paying more attention to?
Well, the D.C. government, the District of Columbia government, and that's the mayor and the attorney general, sort of scared the pants off of a lot of gun control advocates this week when they put before the Supreme Court a request to hear their case on the D.C. Circuit Court striking down their handgun ban. So they pretty much handed over to the Roberts Court a chance to settle law around the Second Amendment. I think that is going to be a sort of a big question moving forward.
That's going to be huge when it gets when it finally gets debated. Nancy Scola, AirAmerica.com, our head blogger over there. Steve Rendell, FAIR's senior analyst and co-host of its national radio show Counterspin, FAIR.org, the website. Steve and Nancy, thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Nancy. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, Talk Radio News from Washington, D.C. Coming up next.
Tom Hartman Program, Viagra for your brain, on Air America Radio. Call
8662└└► Apropos of our conversations the last 2 hours, I guess, about gay marriage and about whether we have too many people in the United States. Ah, yes, Jim Turr with his breed. Wendy Wang with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Talk Radio News on the line with us. Hey, Wendy.
Hi there, Tom. I just got back from New Hampshire. Of course, you guys all heard about the debate that happened at the University of New Hampshire last night between the Republican candidates for the...
You were there?
I was there. I was there. I was at the spin room afterwards, and I chased down a couple of the individuals, including John McCain and Duncan Hunter, to ask them to reflect for us a little bit more on what they had to say, and maybe they could add something more for us. And one question that I put to Senator McCain was the fact that General Peter Pace, the outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs, also called for a drawdown of the troops, which he seemed adamantly to be against. And he said, of course, that it was all General Casey's fault, that General Casey originally had a very faulty plan in place, and he has full faith, full confidence in General Petraeus now to turn the situation in Iraq around, and we just need to give him the to do so.
Hmm. Interesting. I'm curious, Wendy, what you were physically there, and you know we've heard about how when the woman in the diner, well, I saw it. I mean, you know, we saw it on TV. The woman in the diner said that she thinks that if people are in love, they ought to be able to get married regardless of their gender. And there was it looked like there was a lot of applause for that. And then I think it was Brownback said, no, we need a constitutional amendment, and got booed. What's your sense of where the audience was at on that? And what was the demographic of that audience? Was it largely a university age audience, or was it right across the board?
You know, in the front rows, of course, were the guests of the candidates who were standing on the podium. But towards the back, there were a lot of students and a lot of locals. It looked like a very mixed body. And there were cheering throughout the entire debate. Anytime somebody said something, I think the least applause that we heard were for the individuals rather than what they said. It seemed like Duncan Hunter didn't really garner much applause, neither did Thompson and Credo. A lot of the audience members were applauding when Senator Brownback said the thing that he said about having a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage, but then the other half we heard booing in mixed in with the cheering as well. So it's a very mixed demographic. We like to think that New Hampshire is more libertarian at times, but it looked like the audience that night were very balanced. I think it might have been intentional. I don't know how they managed to invite the audience to come in.
Yeah, interesting. And afterwards there was this poll that was done, you know, during and immediately afterwards, where you could text message your vote into Fox News, and at the end of the poll, it turned out. In fact, I have here's the Hannity and Combs announcing the winners.
And here are the results as of now. In first place with 35%, Ron Paul. Rudy Giuliani came in second.
Oh, here we go again.
Driving Hannity
it's
crazy.
It's driving me crazy.
With 16% of your votes, 17% of your votes that just changed. In third place, Mike Huckabee. We'll talk to in just a moment, 15%.
So Ron Paul won the debate, according to Fox News viewers. This is not on the front page of today's New York Times. Or even any of the conservative media. Why not?
You know, Ron Paul is the only libertarian up there. He is the only person who is very much anti-war. On every single question related to Iraq, he always brought back to the fact that we need to not make any more mistakes, that we need to admit that we did wrong in Iraq and have a different policy. He and Mike Huckabee actually went at each other over this very issue, and Ron Paul was saying that neoconservatives are responsible for the deaths that are taking place and that they're losing elections and they're losing people. And Mike Huckabee, of course, said that, yes, granted, we did go into the war on a mistake made on part of the administration, but it's a Pottery Barn kind of rule. We broke it. We must fix it. But Ron Paul got a lot of applause from the audience for admitting that we made a mistake. And I think, you know, a lot of the conservative news outlets, especially Fox News, don't really want to highlight that somebody is actually standing there saying that we need to pull out of Iraq. When you have somebody like John McCain saying the search is working, I mean, he answered a question in terms of whether or not we should pull back the troops, and directly after Mitt Romney had said that the search is possibly working, probably working. I mean, John McCain was adamant about that. It is actually working. So Ron Paul is absolutely away from the pack when it comes to all of that. And I think the audience member felt it when you are actually there. But with the news media and the way that they want to spin it in terms of the Republicans, I mean, that is just not going to play well to their constituency.
Yeah. Was it your sense being there in the room with everybody that it's possible that 35%, I mean, 35% of people voted for Ron Paul in the Fox News poll. Number two is Rudy Giuliani at 15%. Is it possible that 35%, that a third of the audience actually felt that Ron Paul won the debate and that they would vote for him?
To be that way. A lot of people were cheering for him, but then we saw a plane fly overhead as we were walking towards the auditorium with Ron Paul for president above the sky, and a lot of young people out there really chanting his name. So he had a lot of momentum going into the debate, so maybe his supporters just showed up in mass as well. But I think he did a very good job overall.
Great. We got to wrap it up. Wendy Wang with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks a lot, Wendy. Coming up tomorrow, Anything Goes Friday, Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie. Give us a shout. We'll be taking your calls on any topic you want. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there and get active. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.